Hi and welcome to episode 52 of Leader Horse to Water, the Equine Training and Behaviour Podcast. I'm your host, Trudy Dempsey. In this episode, I am thrilled to talk wild and feral horses with the wonderful Sam Cooper. We delve into Sam's backstory right up to her present day training with her own horses and her work as a behaviour consultant. Sam is board chair of the Onaki Catalogue Foundation, a group dedicated to compiling citizen observations of the Onaki wild horses in Utah, USA, in the pursuit of research and public education. With the foundation, Sam teaches a course on wild horses at the University of Utah 3 times a year. Sam ended a career in material science to pursue education about wild horse behaviour and to become a full-time behaviour consultant. I hope you'll enjoy this episode as much as we enjoyed recording it. And don't forget, you can catch up with all my courses and things that are happening in my world at equine.training. Coming up on the 2nd of April, I have a webinar at understandhorses.com where I'm going to look at how you can train your horse to come back to you. Perfect for teaching your horse to be caught comfortably and with no stress, and for lots of other little things as well. Anyway, on with the podcast. So, hi, Sam. It's really lovely finally to get you on the podcast today.
Yeah, I'm extremely excited. It's been a little bit in the works, and I apologize that I've taken a bit of time to get moving on it, but it's really awesome to be on here and get to talk a little bit with you.
Oh, no problem. Everyone gives in the end, and I get round to most people, so that's brilliant. I'm thinking back to when I first met you or heard of you. I think I heard of you and kind of slightly met you on just one of Justine's courses, and she let me just in the back door so I could see how the courses worked. And I think you were doing her mentorship, and then you did one of my training courses. And by the end of that training course, everyone knew Sam as being like the go-to geek for finding the paper. If you said, are there any studies covering this? And Sam knew where to find them. So you are really my massive geeky friend, which I love. But today, apart from the fact that you'll bring some geekiness to everything that you know you do, we're actually going to have a more personal look at, for you personal and sometimes with my work, your work with feral, your own feral horses, and talk a little bit about that. But as I always do with people's first time on the podcast, can you dig back to when you first fell in love with horses and a little bit about that journey and how that's got you to where you are today? Because I know it's really interesting because you've given up your previous academic life to now work with horses, which is incredibly exciting and probably terrifying as well. But yeah, take us back to when Sam fell in love with horses. And
I will say I probably don't remember when I fell in love with horses, because it's been, at least on my mom's side of the family, since her family before that, etc. So my mom's a veterinarian, and so she is a large animal veterinarian, so primarily is working with horses, sometimes also other livestock. But she was taking clients with horses while, you know, she was pregnant with me, and didn't stop until very, very late. And rumor has it, and I don't know if I'm remembering the story correctly, so I'm sorry, Mom, if you're listening, but rumor has it is that not that long before I was born, she got shocked by the neighbor's electric fence working with one of her horses. So that was probably my most recent like memory with horse things is just that, you know, that trigger of my mom being around horses. And so I was being put on them since, you know, before I could walk, you know, my mom was putting me on her childhood horse. And the first horse that I ever had was this young mare who, she was well known for kind of bucking off new riders by the family, and I'm not sure exactly how my mom got a hold of her, but she was one of the family ranches, and somehow ended up being decided to be the kid's horse. She never bucked with me once. It turns out she had basic arthritis in the knee, which I suspect with extra weight was a contributing factor to some of the behaviors that were seen in her. But she was an excellent mare. I mean, we went all over. And so I grew up basically riding bareback and wandering, you know, a whole bunch of old ranch property around where I grew up. So I grew up in the state of California in the United States, kind of 40 miles east of Sacramento, for any of your USA listeners may know where that is. And it was basically at one time, one giant ranch that sold out and became smaller communities. At this point in time, it's gotten much more busy with many different residences. But when I was a kid, most of it was undeveloped. And so there was just thousands of, you know, acres of land that we could just wander around on. And then I would say I knew horses more on a casual level at that age, you know, where you kind of worked a little with neighbors' horses, you work with your own horses. We had three of our own personal ones. And then as I got older, I started to get more interested in things like the show world. So I started to work for a neighbor who bred performance paint horses, paint the breed, not paint the color. And so my job was to work with the young foals. And so in my teens, I did a lot of working with brand new babies, you know, weanlings, getting them haltered, getting them used to their first farriers, all of that kind of thing, using basically primarily negative reinforcement techniques. That slowed down a bit when I went to college. If this is too much detail, please let me know.
Fabulous detail. I mean, as okay. I said to you earlier, you know, this is my kind of dream from when I was a kid reading, you know, the Pullen Thompson books, and America was this amazingly exotic sort of place. So carry on.
Sure. Yeah. I did a little bit of helping out at shows, but that wasn't really where I wanted to be. I've never been drawn to competition. I've always been really more interested in, you know, how do you develop a confident horse with multiple people handling it? And just get them prepared for the world. And I've always been really interested in sort of that human horse partnership. My opinions of that have varied over the course of years, but that's very much where I was at that point in time. And so it was a very exciting experience to be able to take these young foals and get to bring them up to, you know, about one-ish when they would go on to other places where they would go to trainers that were specializing in training the performance-based behaviors, et cetera. During all that time, I continued to get carted around with my mom in her truck, and help out with clients, holding horses, you know, talking to clients, taking information that mom would need to collect. And so I would get a lot of interesting data input from that experience, where we'd see physical issues and we'd have behavioral issues that occurred as a result. And so it was an informal way for me to sort of see a lot more variance in different horses than I think a lot of people are fortunate to get. There was a lot of 3 a.m. calls where we would arrive, you know, with a colicking horse or a horse that had a huge laceration in the leg, et cetera. There were a lot of also, this happened a week and a half ago and it's now an emergency that we would encounter. And so you got to meet a lot of people that way too. And I think when I was younger, I was less keen on the people and more keen on the horses. I was very much a horse person. And as I've gotten older, I really look back fondly back on those experiences, because as I'm finding, I actually really am enjoying the people as much as the horses these days. It's really all of them together and not just the horse, because if we're working with domestic horses, it's not just the horse. It's the people that surround them. Anyway, so then when I went off to college, it got a lot harder because I just didn't have as much time. I wasn't at home with my mom. So I went to UC Davis undergraduate for geology, funny enough, because I wanted to be outside. And that was sort of the compromise that my parents and I arrived on. They weren't really comfortable with me doing anything in regards to pets or art or any of those things that I wanted to actually do. They wanted me to do a hard science, right? So I was allowed to pick from like chemistry or physics. And I said, well, geology's outside, that has chemistry, physics, can I do that? So that was the acceptable compromise. So that's what I went for. And while there, I helped teach students. There's an ag center and like an equestrian center at UC Davis that actually lets people who aren't like really young, but older folks, people that are at the college or people from outside the college that want to learn to ride horses that maybe didn't get that experience when they're younger. And so I was part of a team of people that were teaching folks how to learn to ride. And as a result of kind of growing up on the bareback riding experience, I would be honest, my riding skills were not fantastic. I would say I was a decent teacher, but I had a lot to learn still and how to properly balance on a horse. It was good enough to teach folks, but that was sort of my next pursuit after that. After I finished my bachelor's in geology at UC Davis, I then went for a master's and a PhD in Utah. And while there, I was really fortunate to work at a wonderful barn up in Park City in Utah. You know, big fancy dressage horses. This one was specializing in Frisians specifically, although they had others there. I was riding mostly an Appendix Quarter horse, and there was some warm bloods and I think a thoroughbred cross, and every now and then we would get a pony in. And that's when I first started kind of like peeking into the positive reinforcement world. It kind of overlapped a little bit with that. So the barn that I was at didn't do that at all. They were kind of a very traditional classical dressage technique. But I had been really interested in training my own horse back home how to do spins. And so at the time I was doing the dressage, I was also looking at things like people like Warwick Schiller and stuff that we see more in the natural horsemanship world and side of things. And there were some folks there that were talking a little bit about behavior and learning and how animals learn. And I pursued that pretty aggressively at that point. I was like, this is fascinating. No one's ever really sat down and been like, here's the science that we have of how animals learn. I mean, it's always been like, oh, these people have great timing and feel. These people are really good with horses. They're gentle with them. But I didn't even realize there was a whole nother channel of the world where you could actually see the studies and you could actually get down into the nitty gritty science. And of course, here I am doing another science-based master/PhD, eventually became a PhD. And so I was all about it. I really wanted to dig into that science. And so the first course that I actually took was one with Lauren Frazier and with Robin Foster. And they were talking about fear-based behaviors in horses. I can't remember exactly what the course was called. But they presented a lot of different material on these very subtle signs in horses, on how you could tell they were uncomfortable, how you could sort of predict these fearful responses that would occur. And for me, that was a big opener of my mind, because I would say that the traditional idea with horses is that they will startle. It's not always predictable. They're a prey animal. So, you know, they're always looking out for danger, and that's just something you have to live with. But here we have, you know, some fairly rigorous science that comes back and says, well, maybe not. You know, maybe there are some things that we can look for to help predict when we are more likely to get a fear-based response. From there, I got led into things like Susan Friedman's courses on living and learning with animals, and really delved into animal behavior. And then I wanted to look more into things like Panksepp, and I'm not sure if I've pronounced his name correctly. But then looking more into the emotions, because there's always the debate of if we're looking at just the behavior and the action response, we're not doing the horse justice, right? Because they're a living, breathing, thinking, feeling animal with ethological needs, right? And individual opinions. So, you know, all that stuff was going continuously. So I started practicing some positive reinforcement when I went home on my older horse, who, you know, was still around. And at that point it was a gilding that I had gotten from the paint performance barn that I had worked for. I can't remember how old he was at the time. He was probably like 13 or so when I started that, and just the target. And I was terrible at it. I wanted to preload my hand with food. I wasn't very good with my criterion. So like I had this stick with a water bottle, I think it was, stuck on the end of it. And at first I was like clicking for anything in the stick, but he just, you know, he was searching all over for it. But he was a good horse to learn on because he was really tolerant. I mean, he didn't start throwing frustration. He was willing to work through the problems. He's, you know, was a really good boy. So I started there, and then I, you know, started to ask at the dressage barn if I could do a little bit here and there. And they had somebody who had a Clydesdale that they brought in that was almost, it was semi-rescue Clydesdale. I think it was a broodmare that was used for Not sure if it was strictly the Budweiser commercial Clydesdale or if she had a different background, but it was something like that where she was a broodmare for that kind of program. And she had these horrible feet and you couldn't really ride her. And she was had this fungus and, you know, this poor thing didn't have a lot of ability to interact with humans yet because, you know, they were just trying to get her to the point where she could be comfortable. And so I was allowed to start doing positive reinforcement with her, which was a lot of fun. She's probably just shy of 20 hands. And just loved it. I was just using alfalfa pellets with her. And she thought that was the best thing in the world. And so that was a really good time. And I would say that that was my first two main like positive reinforcement horses were there. And then I was hooked at that point. I thought that it was a really amazing way to start getting communication across. And boy, did I realize I had a lot to learn. So I never stopped and never slowed down. I did a lot of different working for different people at different barns. So working student positions. And that's a thing that I still do today. Because what I've found with those positions is that every single person has a very different idea of what they like in the ideal horse. And we have a lot of discussions, I think, in the community about what is a trained horse? What do we want out of a horse? And the more that I work for different people and I try to keep my mouth shut and just let them tell me what they want, I find that there's some overlap, but it's very different. It's incredible the differences. And so I would say that the ideal horse in the world probably doesn't exist. There's no horse that's never going to meet everyone's desires for like what the perfect horse should look like. But it has meant that I have learned a lot about different training styles. And I think it's given me a lot of respect for all of the difficulties that human beings have to deal with. Because not only do they have to navigate a lot of difficult horses that may not match what their ideal dream was, they have to navigate difficult people too. Which I think is a thing we don't give people enough credit for is how hard it is, especially if you have a horse that has behaviors that other people find dangerous. And that are not easy fixes. That's a really, really hard thing to handle.
What I love, and I want you to finish your story, but what I just needed to pitch in there a bit. What I love is the depth and breadth of your experience. You know, we don't have to have competed at top level competition or something to have that deep experience around horses and growing up around them. Working with all sorts of different horses and being open-minded to different people's opinions, I think is massive. And whenever I'm talking to students, you know, who are dead keen to get on and do behavior or whatever, I'm like, you know, get to know people, go and work in a bar or something and get to know people. Then, you know, just work in as many equine situations as you can, because you can't be a horse anything for me, trainer, behaviorist, whatever you want to call it, without that depth and breadth, which you have in buckets. So that was lovely. It's lovely to hear your story because I've heard bits of it, but never, you know, sort of in its entirety. So yeah, so you are now getting all this experience from different places. So where did that take you then, Sam?
Yeah. So I was getting all this experience in different places. And then I was also attempting to do a PhD at the same time. But one of the biggest things that I noticed while taking these courses and working at the barns is there's this huge disconnect in things that I was learning from, you know, people with masters or PhDs like Robin and Lauren. And what I was being told in, you know, a lot of the barns that I was working at, or a lot of the different people from different disciplines that I was learning from. And I wanted to figure out why that might be. Some of it, of course, you can crop up to culture and just different communities. But I had an opportunity to kind of look at what might actually be going on from the horse's perspective, because it turns out where I did my PhD in Utah, there is a wild horse herd that is about 40 miles, if you do a straight line with a crow, west of Salt Lake City, that was pretty darn easy to access. The horses were fairly habituated to human beings, and so they were going to be fairly easy to observe without being bothered by my presence. And I thought, well, if I go out and I catalog the horses and I create myself a little database. I could probably do a good enough personal study to at least be happy with the information that I'm receiving and compare and contrast it to what I've been told. So I ambitiously went out and started to record the horses, took pictures, got all these IDs down, and started posting on like a little Instagram page. I called it the Anarchy Catalog because the horse HMA that I went to, and I'll talk about that in a minute, was the Anarchy HMA. And so I was like, oh, it's a catalog of horses from the Anarchy. And I tried to mirror it after the folks from Norway and the folks in the Pacific Northwest and the United States that were doing studies on orcas. So I tried to kind of emulate that a little bit because I really liked the way that they kind of crossed over some things like local names and also some of the scientific studies. And they really had this good collaborative between folks that would go out touring on boats and tour guides and the actual researchers. And I was like, I want to do that with horses. I want to be able to, you know, take all of this local information and help distribute that back out to the public. You know, if you get all these people visiting, I want to be able to take that and let everyone have access to it. Because there's a lot of people in the world that don't ever have access to a feral horse or a wild horse, and they never really get to see horses be able to behave with each other and with their environment with minimal human influence.
They're definitely not here anyway, but you know, we will put all this in the show notes, but can you just explain briefly while we're on that topic where people can find that, because the YouTube videos are awesome. We'll talk about your courses and stuff at Understand Horses later, but you know, where will, just so that people can go look, where can they find the Anarchy stuff, because I suggest they do.
Yeah, for sure. So if you're specifically looking at just wanting to see some feral horse videos and you don't have the ability to travel, you can go to YouTube. And if you type in Anarchy Catalog Foundation, catalog is spelled like how you would in the UK. And Anarchy is Anaqui. And you'll come up with the Anarchy Catalog Foundation YouTube channel. And we basically drop down a bunch of raw videos there of wild horse behavior. So we let kind of anyone who wants to submit to us. And of course, we have our own team members that will go out and get videoed as well. But our rule is that you can edit for color and such, but don't edit out like any piece of the video from point A to point B, because we really try and give the raw behavior without a bunch of like snippets and snaps where people are putting their own bias on what they want you to see. So yeah, some of the videos are, you know, a couple minutes long, some of them are longer, and we've got different things. We've got mutual grooming, we have agonistic, so like fights between stallions, you know, we've got interactions between mares and foals, and so there's lots of different variety in there, and we try and put in as much different as things as possible, so we're not just focusing on the cool fights, you know, or the cute foals. We're trying to get a good variety so that folks can really get a good idea of, you know, horses spend a lot of their time just eating.
It's dull sometimes but that's good. That's not a bad thing, is it? Really,
it's not. And then as far as folks, especially if you're in the U.S. there's actually a fair amount of ability to see wild horses here. And even if you travel over, there are quite a number of herds that are fairly well popularized that you can actually go out and do yourself. Like, you can come visit. You would need to rent a car in most of the cases. But I'll go over a little bit of, we've got basically three different major places where wild horses are in the US in terms of like governmental control. So I would say that the biggest one that is most well known is the Bureau of Land Management. And these are America's public lands. They're owned by the government, but the idea is that people from the public should be able to utilize the resources on them, and the horses are one of the resources. Those are all over the Western United States. You can go to the Bureau of Land Management page. They've got maps where each of the HMAs are. And so you can be like, oh, I want to go to kind of this area. And then you can do a Google search to see if there are any groups that might, you know, help monitor horses, and you can talk to them about going out to see them. So that's a really good option. You know, take binoculars and just go watch, go out and observe. There's no reason you shouldn't. And then the Forest Service in the U.S. is another good place. Really, they don't have as many resources as the Bureau of Land Management because they're not quite as big, but they do manage a few. And then the other ones, we have a few like places like National Seashore. So many people have probably heard about Assateague and Chincoteague. I think there are movies and books and so on that have been made about them. So they're known fairly worldwide. And those are places you can actually go and drive your car through, and those horses are very habituated. And so those are not a bad introduction to for horses. It's a little different. They behave a little differently, I think, in their interactions with humans than they do in, say, some of these more remote HMAs where they're going to see your car and run, right? Those ones see your car and go, oh, can I steal a bag of chips, right? but you still get to see horses getting to be horses with minimal human influence. Right.
Yeah.
So even if it's a little different, like I think that those are still very valid horse behaviors to look at. And so, yeah, in the U.S., all of our horses, at least according to the most recent science, have been brought in from basically Europe. So there's the traditional story, which is Spanish horses that were brought in and escaped or released. And then later you had ranching operations during westward expansion where ranchers would turn horses out and mix them. And so we get a combination of that going on. And then the Bureau of Land Management has continued to take horses out and put horses back on to kind of adjust for the genetic variety. And so there isn't really this like very steady timeline. There's been a lot of just like mixing and churning that has gone on.
Mm.
But they are the same species as the horse that went extinct in North America. So it's an interesting discussion that occurs a lot in management circles and also in the domestic horse circles on, you know, do we call them wild or feral? What are the implications of that from an ecological standpoint and also from a behavior standpoint? I mean, if they are a domestic horse that was released, you know, how close to a wild behavior are we actually getting, or are we seeing a domestic behavior? And so it's very interesting discussions and debates that come across there. I don't have answers. I only have data and more questions. But I think it is really cool that they are the same species and that thing does exist. So when I say feral, usually I'm referring to a population that has been primarily domesticated and has been released. And then in America, oftentimes I'll use the term wild because we actually have a legal term in the Bureau of Land Management that specifically refers to them as wild. And so that is at least correct within the span of the law, even if certain scientists would maybe not agree with the use of the term wild. Others would. There are some scientists that are arguing that the horses in the U.S. are a reintroduced species, and so that would categorize them, you know, as wild versus feral. And I think that gets into semantics, and I think you need like 5 PhDs to unpack all of that, to be honest, but it's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. And to be honest, does it matter? What we're seeing is very, very lightly managed horse populations, less managed, although obviously it sounds like some in the US are managed as much as ours are here. But, you know, like locally to me, I've got Exmoor ponies, and some of those herds will be relatively well managed and will have a lot of human contact. Others will have very little, especially the foals each year. You know, they're just going to be rounded up and brought in and won't have had any human contact. So I think we all can appreciate that some of these are less managed than others, and probably the ones that I've seen where you're filming the Onaki horses, they seem very, very lightly managed and are not into people at all. So I think it's a whole different thing. So I don't have any issue. I have no PhD and no wish to discuss it further than to accept that, you know, there's that legal framework in the US. But it's an interesting one, as you say, and often it's just accepted that the whether a horse is re-released into the wild is whether it's feral or not, and that there are truly no, I think there's a couple of asses somewhere in maybe Africa, I can't recall, that are truly wild. And people will say the Chevalsky horse is wild, but again, then those PhD people will say maybe they're not. So, but it's what I'm fascinated by is
that journey of yours to, that's so you, isn't it? You know, like I could take data and I could,
yeah,
you're probably one of my least scared of data students I've ever, ever had, because, you know, if I say to you, let's take data, you're like, yes. It's like, yeah, I can work with data. If I don't know what I'm doing, I would be lost. So I love that about you, that you just went out there and thought, I'm going to put together this catalogue and we're going to work. And what I don't know whether people picked up, but I know, is that, you know, you are sharing that information. You're sharing footage with people that visit and, you know, working on the names. That I felt was fascinating, because, you know, obviously you can identify most of these horses out there, and there's often conversations, you know, between, is that this one or a different one? So I love that that's happened. But how does that bring Sam round to what I know about you and having two of your own horses that you have come, well, miles with, in my opinion, from where you started with them? But tell us a little bit about how that happened and what you're up to with them now.
Yeah, so they are from that herd that in the West Desert in Utah, that I was basically attempting to make a study out of, and of course that spiraled out into a total foundation and all these other things, but they are from sort of the more main core herd out there, which is the most popularly photographed one. So we had pretty decent records by the time that those horses were rounded up. And they're rounded up by the Bureau of Land Management by helicopter, with the intention of population control. So one of the issues that we have in the West is that a variety of factors have basically led to most predators that potentially could prey on horses are no longer there. And so horses tend to breed, they have foals, and then there isn't much ecological pressure that causes foal reduction. And so you continue to get population increase. And the Bureau of Land Management wants to only have a certain number. And so they will go in and remove horses. And then those horses are placed for adoption. So the roundup occurred in 2021. And at that point in time, I had just finished my PhD, basically, and was about to start a job with a big national lab, Los Alamos National Laboratory in the United States. So I was doing a lot of moving. I was in a very uncertain position, and I didn't have any horses at the time. I had basically said, for financial reasons, I'll do working student positions. I'm going to continue to be involved with horses, but I can't have any of my own. You know, I'm not in a good spot for it. And horses are a huge burden financially, right? You never know when somebody's going to have a sand colic or swallow a stone or, you know, break a leg or who knows what. But I knew that I had spent so much time and energy investment in these horses, and I knew these horses really well, each individual one. I knew their personalities really well. And I said, I'm not going to have a better time or a more important time to get a horse than now. I've wanted a Mustang since I was a kid, though I had sort of written it off as I'd gotten older, just because there's a lot of time and energy that goes into teaching a feral horse behaviors. But I didn't have a facility, right? I had just moved to Los Alamos, and to say that anything up there is really well equipped for Mustangs would not be true. It's not. I was fortunate to be able to find some folks who were generously had like an open lot, which is, you know, basically a dirt paddock up there, that they were willing to let me bring horses into that spot. But the height of the fences were only 5 feet. So I wasn't going to be able to safely take these wild horses, put them in those paddocks, and train them. What I likely would have had was a wreck where a horse jumped a fence and now they were on a busy road and we had no one around that would be able to have the roping skills or the trailering skills to be able to handle these wild animals. So I basically started reaching around looking for trainers. And as I think those of us who tend to be strongly invested in the positive reinforcement community know, the chances of us finding, like, say, a pure positive trainer or a trainer we've been able to sit down and really watch is very slim. And so I was thankful that I had a few folks that I had been following for some time that I got to see kind of the progression of horses from start to finish. And I knew a few people who actually did integrate positive reinforcement in and try and stay more on the gentler side of negative reinforcement training. And I reached out and those trainers were willing to take on the horses. I don't want to say who, not because I have anything against them, but because I don't know if they want their names included here. And so I'm trying to be respectful in that regard. So they went down off to them to get, you know, basically haltering, feet handling, you know, all their basic behaviors done so that they would be safe in that 5 foot pen. And then I could take it from there. So I was terrified. I was extremely excited. These were going to be my first personally owned horses as an adult. So all of their care, all of their food, all of their responsibilities were going to be on my shoulders. And that was, it wasn't like I'd never cared for horses before. I was caring for mine growing up. But the financial contribution is that big one when you switch over to paying for everything yourself, and finding the vet yourself and the farrier. And you know, it's a big step. And I also at that point didn't, I think, quite have an understanding of the variety of levels that horses would be at when they got them. I had worked with clients who had horses that had been TIP trained. TIP is basically a trainer incentive program where trainers put on the basics, and then they get a little bit of money from the government, and then they adopt that out to somebody. And so I had an idea of like, oh, the horses will come. They'll know how to pick up their feed. They'll know how to load in the trailer. Like, that's great. They're basically, they got the basics down. And I would say that they did. They knew all of those things when they arrived, but they were not okay with me as a person yet. They came and they were still afraid. I remember when Nova arrived, she had, like, she would let you catch her. She would stick her nose in the halter because that had been used, trained with positive reinforcement, right? It was really nice behavior. But if you went to touch her neck, she would twitch down her neck and her whole side. And her head would be up in the air and she would be rigid. And it instantly clicked for me. Like, okay, these horses know their behaviors really well. They've been trained excellently, responded to pressure really well, beautiful feel. They were internally not okay with it. And I think that as I have been working through getting okay with it, you know, that was basically all I did was first I did kind of a CAT-H protocol. And for those that don't know, it's basically a constructional approach where you find the threshold for the horse. And then you stay a little outside of it, wait for them to go back to their normal behaviors, and then you leave to give them a break and you kind of repeat. And then once I was close enough, I started adding food with the idea of doing counter conditioning. But it was months of just that, of just approaching horses and getting them comfortable, because that just wasn't there yet. And I've learned that part where you actually build a relationship and trust with the horse, where you bring them down to feel okay with what's around them, not just know how to behave in their environment, but really be okay with it, is a long process. There is no way to make that go fast. It's, you can get your behaviors really good and still have a horse that's terrified, regardless of whether you're using positive reinforcement or negative reinforcement. And so that's basically been my journey for the last, let's see, I got the one filly who's a year old right now in June of 2022, I believe it was. And then the gilding in December of 2022. And that's been what I've done, is a lot of just earning their trust, helping them to get comfortable with their environment, and really helping them understand that novel things, they can be curious about them, that new things are possible to be fun, that, you know, that they're going to be safe. Yeah, it's been a really, really long process. But very rewarding.
I love that you've said that. It's always rewarding, isn't it? It's fabulous. But I'm glad you've said that, because I've mentioned to you that it would be good to have this chat, because I have a client at the moment. So shout out to Chess, who's going through this herself with her little feral rescue. He's a feral. He's not a rescue. He's awesome. But because he wasn't handled, and because he doesn't know people, and because obviously they're bred outside and do their own thing, and then all of a sudden people come into the equation, it's exactly what you said. You know, they're okay with things. He's okay for somebody to bring him hay. He's okay for somebody to you know, fence him in and move him around. But he's not okay with people. He really isn't. You know, it's taking him a long time, and she'll be really pleased to hear you mention Kat, because she's got used to Kat. And you know, I don't know about you, but my feelings are that the more choice and control you give them at those early stages. So lots of people will say, oh, but I could get a rope over his neck. You know, you talked earlier about if they got out, you'd need somebody with rope skills that is going to be able to lasso a horse and catch them. I know. I remember my first feral horse. We bought a house in France, and it came with a horse who couldn't be caught. And after they took his testicles off, he was never caught again. And until I caught him. And when I was looking around, there were only one sort of way of doing it, and that was you somehow trapped them and then they just gave in. they basically were flooded. And so for me, that choice, but it takes a long time, doesn't it? I mean, it's not yeah. a quick fix, and people maybe aren't prepared for that, and I think that's quite a hard sell, isn't it?
I think it's extremely hard to sell. And I think that it's even more hard to sell when you are a trainer who is expected to have horses to someone quickly enough that you can still feed yourself, right? Yes, you could spend the time to try and help this horse feel comfortable with novelty and control. But if, you know, you need to have horses in and out in 3 months and you need to make sure they can get on a trailer without killing themselves and someone else, you know, maybe it's the least of the two evils to train this behavior when the horse is fearful and then let the owner do it later where they're building the bond and they're giving the horse control. But I think one of the big problems is that a lot of owners get horses without the understanding that it's going to be a long, long road. Mm-hmm. And they have a hard time differentiating that fast sell. Yes, I can get these behaviors fast with this method, but I'm going to end up with a lot of consequences as a result that maybe I didn't intend for or didn't want. And I would say, especially with the gilding, you know, I started trying to incorporate control into his environment very quickly. And I added a lot of novel things to his environment, like different types of waters and different types of flavors, just things that were new, that were good. And he would start to learn the objects that were good, and he was comfortable with those, right? And he could pick and choose what he wanted to interact with there, but there was no curiosity. He would prefer, if there was something new, to kind of stand in his corner and look at you, but he didn't want to come engage, really. Like, he'd been taught to face up and walk over to you, so he'd rest next to me because that was the place where there was no pressure, but he didn't really want to interact. You know, he just was like, this is safe, I'm going to be here. And I would say it wasn't until we met his ecological needs. I had to move from New Mexico all the way up to Washington State with a stop over in California, which for those that don't know is several thousand miles. And thankfully on the way we were able to be in some pasture land with, you know, 3-4 acres in some case. And he was good enough that I could catch him. And so I wasn't super worried about turning him out. And that horse completely started to turn over as soon as he had that space to move. It was literally overnight that he switched over from being like afraid of everything new to starting to like perimeter the 3 acres like he would do as a band stallion in the wild. Basically, he would, you know, check his edges for things. And you know, he started to approach stuff, and you know, he really began to open up then. And that wasn't anything to do with training. That was everything to do with him being able to interact with his environment and have a lot of enrichment, be able to perform his natural behaviors. But he still wasn't curious about new human things. That didn't come until, you know, 6 or 7 months later. In fact, we're just starting to get it where I will be doing things in the pasture and he will come over to see what I'm doing, which is huge for me. I mean, this horse that didn't want to be involved in anything domestic is now like, what you got there? That for me is that moment where I was like, okay, he is finally starting to feel okay in his own skin. This is the horse, it's a real horse that I want to see, not this horse who's learned to survive, right? And he's always been excellent with his behaviors. He would load in the trailer. He would pick up his feet for people, even though you could tell he was afraid. Like, he had learned his stuff very well. But it hasn't until recently that he's been like, yeah, this is cool. I like, he's enjoying the things around him. He's investigating stuff.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And it's interesting how different Nova was, your mare. And, you know, like early on, it's her that I saw you training with. And you know, we almost had that problem where Nova was there ready to train. She was like, yeah, I'm up for this. She was really game for like, especially the positive reinforcement seemed to really engage her and have her more interested sometimes than you might want them to be. But I think that's what people have to understand, that there is no one horse just like that. There is no one feral horse. They're all very different depending on their backgrounds, whether they're mares or stallions or geldings, and the history that they've had since they've been around humans and transport and all that. It's like this big jumbo package of lots of different things. And also, to go back to what you were saying about, it's about how they live. It's not about the training at the beginning. I mean, the training is important because of the welfare of the horse in terms of they need to have their feet done and things like that. But aside from that, really, those big changes come when you can provide a much more natural situation for a horse to be in. And I think people forget that as well. They assume that horses can just tolerate, yeah, come into a stable and be in a stable environment. It must be really difficult for, especially from those horses that you're talking about, the wild horses in the US, really hard to come from, you know, him being a banned stallion sort of like in his brain to how would he negotiate that when he's with you. It's vastly different. So he was born to be something that he hasn't ended up being. So giving him all that support is really, really important, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And even among domestic horses, I find that that's true. You know, horses that have been with people their entire time, especially working with those foals that I did a lot of training out of. And of course, other than me, they hadn't ever had any, you know, handling. They of course, they got fed. They had people wandering around them, but not any formal handling, right? So a lot of times I was their first look at the world. And this was back when I was primarily using pressure release for training. And so, you know, when we were training how to use the halter, we would do a lot of putting a little pressure on the halter and then using the dam to try and facilitate some movement. Or a lot of the time I didn't have a partner, and so I would have to do it all myself. And so I'd put a little bit of pressure, and a lot of times the foal would be like, and go backwards. And you just keep that really light pressure until they thought about it. And then you'd reward for any sort of think forward. But they all had different, you know, feelings. I had one horse that, the barn owner eventually was like, we couldn't get a halter on him. And so they decided that the best thing to do was to grab him, to basically put a halter on him. Right. I have never heard this before, and I have never heard it since, but that horse screamed like a pig. And you know, and it, for somebody outside looking in, they would have thought, wow, what an overreaction. But for that horse, that was terribly scary and traumatizing. Right.
Yeah.
And same thing with my guys. I actually changed my approach a bit with Oberon versus Nova, because things that I was able to do with her that she was comfortable with, he was like a way no go for him. Right. And so rather than trying to keep them to this specific method, I always, when I go in, I'm trying to say, I want to collect that data. This is where I really love the data. I want to see if what we're doing is actually working, or if I'm just thinking it's working. And the horse eventually learns despite me, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
that's really so important. And I know you have already said how much you're good at taking data, but people find that quite hard, Sam. So what you did with, because I've seen how you take data and it is very serious, but you know, people don't have to be as serious as that, do they? You know, they can literally note some things down in a diary and, you know, see how things progress, but it's still worthwhile doing to decide whether, well, to determine whether your horse is actually learning something, because obviously reinforcement is only something we can know after the event. So yeah, have you got any tips on the sort of things people might be looking for if they want to take a little bit of data? Because I think data, it supports you. It stops you thinking, I'm getting nowhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think and you'll hear this all the time, and this is easier said than done, but I think keeping it as simple as possible. The hardest thing about data collection is not deciding the data to collect. It is not processing the data. It is literally actually getting yourself to take it. And if you overcomplicate it, if you make it too hard, you're not going to do it. It doesn't matter if you've got the best idea in the world and if that data would lead you to the best answer in the world. If you aren't actually collecting it, then it does you no good. So pick the easiest possible thing that you can think of that you would say is improvement. So if you're doing something like, let me pick a really easy example. You are trying to get from point A to point B, right? And you just want a horse that walks calmly from point A to point B. Then, you know, I think that the best thing to do for that data collection is just once a session, you know, every time the horse goes across, you just write down a little note for yourself. You can say, did the horse's movement seem choppy, smooth, or sluggish? That's a really simple data set you can take, and you can collect it over time. It doesn't require you to do anything fancy like, oh, the horse moved at this exact speed and do, you know, any crazy data collection. But we're pretty good at observation as human beings. I think our biggest problem is that we tend to interpret, which is where we fall into pitfalls. We want to collect the data and then interpret it right away, as opposed to collect it and then process it and then interpret it. And so you will naturally be pretty good at noticing whether that horse was sluggish or choppy or smooth. And that's going to be close enough, you know? Whereas talking about how I would do it, cause I'm insane, I would be like, okay, I'm going to record a start time and a stop time, and I'm going to compare the times each time, and I'm going to have a video over the top of it. Like, you don't need to do all that. And I will be honest, when I do stuff like that, a lot of the time I stop because I don't collect enough data and it's no good to me anyway. So it's much better to just take the simple data.
Yeah.
And once you get to the point where you're like, five times out of six, I now am seeing smooth during my sessions, you can say, I've made improvement. But if you just see a random, you know, plot where you're like, okay, here's my time and here's my sluggish, choppy, smooth, and it's all over the place, right? They're wiggling up and down over time. You're like, okay, well, there's no pattern there. So I'm actually doing anything. I'm making no progress. Keeping it really simple.
Yeah, that's awesome advice. And I think that would help people who struggle with data to take any. And often when I have a client, I am their data taker because they then don't have to worry too much about it. And they send me videos and I can see the difference and I can say, yeah, you did great there. You weren't getting that close to your horse last week and now you are constantly getting up close and they're wanting to interact with you. So if you've got a video camera, you can be my eyes just the same way as I look at it. You can look at it too. And I think it's important to just get yourself used to doing that, especially if you're working with ferals, because I think it can be really, really a drain on you when you think you're getting nowhere. And certainly that's happened with my recent client, you know, and I go along and say, wow, that was brilliant, you did really well then. And she's like, oh, I didn't think we were really making much progress. So somebody else's eyes, or you looking at your video afterwards as somebody else almost, it's amazing what you start to see. So I love Sam's advice about, you know, just keep it simple, but take some data. And if you can't take video, as she says, just write it down, just make a note of whether it was of how it was, what was the approach like. I think that's wonderful. So also, I want to dig back a little bit, Sam. You mentioned about there being no one size suits all. And I'm a big believer, obviously, in that. But people do like, don't they? They like a method. And there are a lot of methods out there. But when you're looking at feral horses particularly, you've got to be very open-minded, haven't you? And how did you find that difference? Because obviously Oberon and Nova are very, very different, and your approaches had to be very different. You know, what sort of things did you draw on to stop you trying to replicate what you did with Nova, or was it just an impossibility? There was no way that was going to happen with Oberon.
Oh, that's a tricky question. some of each really went on where I would try a thing that I had tried with domestic horses or with Nova, and I would not get the response that I had desired. I would see the horse that would kind of lift his head and go rigid, or he would actually turn away, or I would get a startle, right? I would be in positions where, at least when we're trying to stay strictly with positive reinforcement and strictly with really low thresholds, even if we're using negative reinforcement, people are like, oh, never get that behavior, you're a bad person, right? And I was like, oh no, I'm a bad person, right? And so, but you know, as with anything, we all make mistakes. Rather than continuing to be in that position, I said, okay, I need to stop. I need to reassess. I'm going to take a couple days off. He will not be in trouble if I don't train him for a couple days. And I'm going to sit down, go to the drawing board, and think about what I know from feral horse behavior, what I know from working with domestics, and you know, what I've learned from people like you and other people that are you know, really invested in taking the time it takes and adjusting to the horse's personality and what you have in the moment. Mm-hmm. And so I'd formulate some plans and I'd go out and I'd say, okay, I'm going to do 2 minutes. I'm not going to do any more than that. And I'm going to see where I am at the end of that. And I will adjust from there. I think one of the things I learned from Nova that I didn't get to learn from domestic horses that I think are an excellent thing to learn from feral horses is just calling it quits earlier. I would get very frustrated with myself that I wasn't making proper progress. And I'd go, no, I need to get this right. And I would just want to keep doing it until I got that one perfect response. And that's one of the benefits I think I've found from positive reinforcement is it gives you more permission to stop when things aren't going well. You don't necessarily have to end on a good note. The goal is to have a greater number of positive responses versus your ones that are not the behavior you want. And so you can go, oh, this isn't working well. I am going to stop and then come back at it with a new plan and fix it later, rather than getting stuck in this. I have to keep picking at it today, right now, until I get a positive answer, which is where my mindset had come from negative reinforcement, is that like, you know, you just keep picking away at it until you've got a better answer, right? Mm-hmm. And that I think has been the hardest thing to let go, and really would have left me in a world of hurt if I had tried that with Oberon. And so, yeah. You know, learning to quit as soon as I saw the signs of this isn't going the way I want it to, let's not push it. Let's back off. Let's reassess. Come back in a few minutes. Come back the next day. Come back in a few days. And also giving the horse time to process. Nova was ready the next day to go. Like, if she'd had a traumatic thing happen, she was fine the next day. She was very malleable. She'd recovered. She was willing to try it again. Sometimes she was so willing that she'd put herself in positions that she probably shouldn't have been in. But Oberon's like, I need 4 days to process this thing that happened to me. And so I got comfortable with letting him have those 4 days.
It's hard though, isn't it? It is. And this is something with Chess that I've been having recently, you know, it feels so close to being able to touch her pony, but if she touches him, she'll go back to square one and he'll be like, this is the person that tries to touch me and I'm not ready to be touched yet. And I'm so proud of her because often she'll say, I held back, I stopped myself. I wanted to, but I didn't. And I think that's very hard from the human perspective because we have for so long had this mentality that we can't let them win, that we are in charge of them, that we should control them. And so it's a whole different way of looking at things. I love your idea of setting a time, and you know, I'll either suggest that people set a time limit by, you know, putting an alarm on their phone, or maybe they can just put a limited amount of food into their bag or whatever they're delivering food from so that they don't go beyond it, because it is so easy. It's like you say, you keep doing it and sometimes then there's not that way out. You keep doing it and the only way things are going to end is by deterioration because you've just kept going too long. So I love those points. I think calling it quits early is probably my number one tip
with working with ferals. Do less than you think you want to every single time. I think that's, you know, going to be, and seeing them as individuals, definitely, it is so important. And your guys have taught you that in abundance.
Yeah, absolutely. And I they are both very different. And I would say I love that. I think I struck gold with both of them. And maybe it's just that I love all horses, but you know, Oberon is so quiet, even when he's pretty worried, and very soft. I can have people who don't know much about horses, you know, walk up to him and pet him, and if they follow everything, everyone's just fine. And he's just he's incredibly gentle for a horse that is pretty much afraid of his own shadow when he arrived. He is one of the most incredibly gentle horses that I have ever met. And then you've got Nova, who sees something that worries her and she will charge it down and face it head on, you know, and I love both of those personalities. I think, I think it's great that we get to live in a world where we have these animals that have such rich opinions and such differences.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to know that. I was talking to Polly on the last podcast, and we were talking about how often people buy very domesticated horses that have been through maybe several owners. And we're talking particularly maybe about people who are using positive reinforcement as part of their training process. And they come to you and it's like they get on the psych couch and go, well, now let me just tell you everything that's wrong with my life. And they just unpack themselves in front of you. And you bought a horse that could be ridden and do competitions, and all of a sudden they can't do anything. They can barely even exist in the field without having a breakdown. And I think once you start to understand the real nature of those horses, and that's what you're doing with your two, is seeing those really completely different natures. They're both horses, but they're so different in their approach to life and everything and learning. And we can't assume anything when we're working with horses, can we? We really can't.
Yeah, I think that's been, and I'm still learning. We're always going to be learning forever. Whenever we're working with animals, right, or humans, like that's never going to stop. But I think that that's something that I have learned the most in the last 4 or 5 years when I've been out watching the wild horses, and now being able to see those same horses go from the wild. I've actually watched their behavior in the wild, and now I get to see them in a domestic setting. Is I've sort of given up on the methodology where people are like, this is the method to use. And obviously I have tips and tricks and I know how behavior works, etc. But when people come to me now and they're like, how do you train a horse? What skill set do I need? You know, what tools do I use? What's the best method? And I just, you know, I feel less able to tell people now than I ever was. And I feel like I'm a much better trainer. And I understand the horses much better as a result, because I am constantly questioning my own belief. I go, okay, I think this about Oberon, or I think this about Nova, or I think this about a client's horse, because I'm working with a lot more people now, in regards to feral horses that are coming with a lot of the problems that Oberon and Nova came with. And I am constantly questioning why I'm giving a specific piece of advice, where that information came from. What do we do if this isn't a scenario where that information can be used in the same way? Because there are so many nuances that you just can't take a one size fits all approach ever. And yeah, there are some patterns that you can use to your advantage, but it's been so freeing to not feel tied to a thing and to have the tools and to have the life experience to be able to adapt on a whim and not be afraid of that, not being like, oh, I must be really bad at this because this isn't working. You're like, no, I've used this many times and it has worked in these scenarios, but because of the way this scenario is set up and because of this horse, we are going to adjust because it's not the correct application for this moment.
Yeah, that is such a great point, Sam. When things aren't working, to not just be able to say, I'm going to stop using that, but to not beat yourself up that you're rubbish because it's not working, because not everything works with every horse. And I am no way as scientific as people like Robin and Lauren and yourself. for me, it's very much a move around in the space and see what works. I'm a very practical person. But it's the same outcome, is that you find the things that work for the individual that you're working with at that time. And you're not just trying to take a pre-organized process, a procedure off the shelf and say, right, this should fit, because it can't. And so sometimes when you stand in front of a horse with a client, you're just thinking on your feet constantly, which is why I think it's so draining sometimes being a trainer or a coach that coaches other trainers who are training their own horses, maybe, because you are expected to be every procedure that you've ever known and to come up with some more creative ones if those don't work. It's hard work, isn't it? It's hard work emotionally for us and you know, in terms of our brain power as well. Well, at least I find that.
No, I agree completely. It is exhausting, and in a great way. I love using my brain in that way. And in addition to the horse, there's always the human factor. I mean, I am fortunate that I had a bunch of skill sets and techniques that I could then apply to Nova and Oberon. But when I come to clients, I have to figure out where their skill sets are and completely change things to fit that. Because it would be wonderful if everyone had this beautiful timing and feel that we yearn for when we're using negative reinforcement. It would be wonderful if people had this ability to perfectly thin slice things for positive reinforcement and have the exact correct click and food delivery timing. But a lot of the people that I show up with don't even realize where their hand is on the rope. You know, a lot of it is, first thing, don't hold your hand in the side of the coil, right? And then they are just feeding food and they may not even be using a click, or they're using something like a good boy, but the good boy occurs as they're delivering the food. And so it has not actually developed to mean anything to the horse. And so that makes another step of, it's incredibly hard. Like, not only do we have to think on our feet for what the horse needs, but now, okay, we're not training the horse, we're having someone else train the horse. So what do we do to make sure we can meet all of these different factors? Yeah. And yeah, it it takes a lot of time and energy. And I really appreciate my family for being supportive to what I'm doing, abandoning this very high paying job to go work with horses. And, you know, I spend a lot of time developing plans for people on the computer, and they're like, oh, well, it'll get easier because you'll be able to copy paste things over. And I'm like, no, I can maybe reuse some pictures, yeah. But the ability to just copy paste is almost non-existent, I would say, in people working with horses who are really striving every day to do a better job with every horse they come across.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. If only copy and paste worked. But, you know, I think what comes easier is that you are able to give that information more quickly, and you're used to the words that you need to use to give that information. But actually giving, you know, this is already pre-prepared, I think is almost impossible. I always teach my students who want to be trainers, you know, how to plan a lesson. But of course, you very, 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 very rarely will ever be able to use a plan from start to finish in a session. It's just not a thing that's going to happen. So you have to be able to think on your feet. You have to be able to be creative, as you say, not just for the horse, but for the client as well. I have two questions sort of to round off with, because, you know, I've already taken up loads of your time, but you're coming on again because I have so many other questions that I know that you can answer. So we'll get you back again. But first of all, I had to laugh when you were saying earlier about your mum and dad and how you were only allowed to do something scientific and serious, and you know, you did the deal. And then me knowing the end of the story, that you've gone back into working with your love of horses. And it makes me think of the same. You know, my parents were like, well, there's, you can do almost anything, but you're not working with horses. There's no way you're working with horses. You can get that one. And of course, yeah, I came back around to it, and you are. So I thought that was quite funny. How does your mum, I know you obviously have dealings with your mum in terms of her being a vet, and how does she see it now? I'm sure she's super proud of you.
It's hard to know with both of my parents sometimes. I think my mom has always been much more supportive internally than she has felt she's able to speak externally. But, you know, I call her most days when I come back from the barn and tell her about some of the things I'm thinking about. You know, I talk to her a lot about interfacing with other veterinarians and how to do that properly. And she has always been willing to listen, even though she's hearing the same subject over and over. So I think, you know, and they've been incredibly supportive with, you know, she actually, when I was moving my horses from New Mexico up, she basically drove with me from California up to Washington, because I didn't really have a lot of resources in California or in Washington at that time for people that knew horses. And I didn't want to have somebody coming along that didn't know horses really well, right? Working with Mustangs, especially Oberon, who was still very fearful. And so if you know, if your mom's willing to drive, you know, 1,000 miles with a highly fearful horse in a trailer, I would say that that's pretty darn supportive. Yeah.
Me too, definitely. And so to my last question, really, Sam, and I know a little bit about where people can find you, but I'd love you to tell people, what are you offering to the public nowadays? You have some great resources. You're a great person to follow with Equine ABCs on social media, because you share some lovely film of your own horses and you have some really great things to say. So certainly would advise that people go and find you on social media. And I know that you're presenting again, albeit not in person this year, you're going to be doing a video link up at Understand Horses Live in July. So if anybody is thinking of being there last year, and I think that's available as a separate course at Understand Horses, people can watch your presentation from last year's Understand Horses Live. So where else can people find Sam, and what can you offer to people, Sam, in terms of what you're working with for clients nowadays?
Yeah, so you've caught me in a position of trying to self-promote, and I'm absolutely horrible at it. I'm very shy. But you know, what I'm trying to do and what I'm hoping to do more now is focus on behavior consultations. So ideally I want to take more locally around here, but it takes a while to get your name out. So I'm also doing a lot of basically virtual behavior consultations. So if horses that are highly fearful, you know, maybe they have gone to a trainer and you've received them back, and maybe they're not in the place you want them to be, right? And so you want some help with some guidance on how can I set up my environment to be better fit to this horse? How can I set up my training to be better fit? You know, how do we work through some of these fear behaviors without basically causing them to get worse, right? And so that kind of thing. So folks that are kind of struggling with problem behaviors, I can do virtual consultations where basically we meet for 90 minutes and we talk about your environmental setup and we talk about your goals and we come up with some game plans to move forward and then continue to meet. And that's really where I want to focus, is on helping people have their own tools for success so you don't have to rely on those around you. The other thing that I'm working on, of course, is trying to get more of information about feral horse behavior out into the public. So there are those resources you talked about with Understand Horses. There's that on-demand course that you can get. There's also a webinar that should be coming up. So keep an eye on Understand Horses if you're interested in that kind of thing. And a few other classes that are in the works that might be a little slow to come out. But yeah, keep your eye in there. It's a great resource for other things as well. I'm sure, Trudy, you've talked about it a lot. But you know, there's Emma Lethbridge, who's got amazing information on trauma and horses, which I highly recommend for anyone working with fearful horses. Trudy, you have amazing training courses on there. Here I'm going, you know, like I said, bad at self-promotion.
You are so terrible. Sam is terrible. It's all about Sam. So Sam, what is your website and what social media areas can we find you on? I think you're probably on TikTok, which I avoid most of the time, but people do love it. So you're on there as well. But tell us, fill us in, where can we find you?
All right. So my website is equineabcs.com. Really simple. And if you want social media, so I do primarily video-based stuff right now. I don't do a lot of blog and writing, although if you are interested in seeing that, send me an email, post on my post, let me know you would rather have something more text-based. But I'm on TikTok, Instagram, and Facebook, all under the moniker EquineABCs. And so you have to do is type that in and I'll pop up. I've got a little horse that's on a block of like the alphabet blocks like kids would use to build things. And that's how you know it's me. So I love to answer questions. That's one of my favorite things. So, you know, ask a question in the comments. I will film you a personal video answering your questions. Sometimes I can be a little slow, but I promise I'm getting to every single one of them. I love to do demonstrations. So if you're like, oh, you know, what's the best way or what's the way you like to do this, I can kind of show you that. And then one of the things I really like doing on the social media channels is taking little pieces of wild horse behavior. These are all films that I've taken from observing different herds in the US. And I'll do little snippets about horse ethology. So things like mutual grooming behaviors, or, you know, how mares might act, or how stallions engage in agonistic behaviors, things like that. And so those are the little brief snippets that give you an idea of how horses would live with a minimal amount of human management. And maybe that can be used for you guys to help bring that back into your domestic settings and how you can set up your environment to better meet those horses' needs.
That's awesome. And you see, you can self-promote, Sam. That was amazing. And yeah, do check Sam out on social media, because she has made already, there's a lot of information there, and she's made some great little videos. And I recently saw you going through something with Nova and answering somebody's question, and that's just fantastic. I'm so impressed when I see people doing that. I am very bad at self-promotion in terms of social media, and so apologies that I don't have lovely films like Sam, but go and find them, because she is absolutely awesome. And we will have you back on again, because there are so many things I want to ask you about, and we can do that in the future and maybe get in a bit more technical another time, because you are, as I say, a wealth of information about all things studies, and I can never ask you the wrong thing, and I know you'll always come up with an answer, which is just fabulous. So thank you for being here, Sam. It's been fabulous to chat to you and to hear your whole story as one, because I've heard little bits of it, but to hear it as one, it's just been fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing that with us.
No, I really appreciate being able to come on here, and thank you so much for your patience with me. And it's a great topic. I love talking about horses. I'm never going to get sick of it. And you're a wonderful person to talk to with a huge breadth of knowledge. So yeah, once again, thank you so much. And looking forward to seeing how it gets edited down and what gets produced.
Nothing. There'll be very little edited. I'm such a lazy person, Sam. There'll be so little. Apart from the bit where your phone overheated in the car. Apart from that bit, I promise I'll take that bit out. That was amusing. But no, thank you so much, Sam. I absolutely loved it. And we'll have you back soon. All the best.
Sounds great. All the best, Rudy.
Thank you for listening. As always, I hope you can share the podcast in as many places as possible. This information only gets out there through you making that effort. Thank you so much to those of you who always do. And if you can give me a 5-star review anywhere that you listen to this, that is possible, that really helps get the podcast pushed in front of more people. Thank you for listening, and hope you're along for the next one very soon.